The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Harry L. Madsen. Mr. Madsen, the appellant, is represented by Mr. Jack Derhagopian, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and the State of South Dakota is represented by Assistant Attorney General Ann Meyer from Pierre. Mr. Derhagopian, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Madsen is a criminal appeal out of Moody County. This is an issue where he's appealing the denial of a motion to suppress the evidence. The issue, I believe, is one of first impression, not only for this court, but for nationwide. And it applies to the application of 25 U.S. Code, Section 1302, Sub 2, which parallels the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and, of course, our state constitution as well. We're asking that that be applied to the casino security officers who searched Mr. Madsen's room in this case. Mr. Madsen was a guest in the Royal River Casino. This was January 12, 2007, a little bit after midnight. Some casino security officers who happened to be in the hallway thought they smelled unburnt marijuana. They reported that back to their security captain, Robert Longfellow. These security people are uniformed. They do carry firearms, and they also carry, of course, handcuffs. Upon this report, Mr. Longfellow devised a plan where he would approach the room, and if he also believed he smelled marijuana, he would tell the tenants of that room that he had a noise complaint, try to gain entry to search, and that's exactly what he did. He also brought along something called a crash bar, which is a means to get past that security thing that you have in hotels, the little chain device or the other thing. And he also had his pass key, which he said he would have used if he would not have been given entrance any other means. So they approached the room. He did smell the smell of unburnt marijuana, put his finger over the little peepholes to disguise the fact that they were uniformed agents of the casino outside of his room. Knocked on it. A guest of Mr. Madsen then opened the door a couple inches just to see what was going on. Tried to close it, at which point Mr. Longfellow put his foot in the door, stopped them from closing the door, and began to push back, saying, "We have a noise complaint, we have a noise complaint." The testimony is perfectly clear that at this point he asked, "Are you the resident?" He says, "No, I'm not the resident." He could not have consented to a search. Mr. Longfellow continued to apply force with the other officers behind him as well, at which point the person inside said, "Then yield." Once inside the room, they began looking around, searching with flashlights and trash cans and all around. Eventually, on the other side of the room, on the floor, there was a butt of marijuana found. That butt of marijuana then turned into the basis for a search warrant. Mr. Longfellow took that butt of marijuana, secured the premises, detained everybody, handcuffed them, took them out of the room, secured the room, called local law enforcement, who then went and applied for a search warrant, a state search warrant. It was a Clamath police officer, a state search warrant. Again, the primary thing was based on that butt of marijuana that was found there. It's our contention at the trial court level that that should be suppressed, that the original search by the casino security officers was illegal, using Fourth Amendment standards, technically not the Fourth Amendment, technically it should be 25 U.S. Code Section 1302, but it parallels the Fourth Amendment, and the prior case law says that we use the same Fourth Amendment case law to determine this.
Does it have to be on, for that sort of, we'll call it the Native American Fourth Amendment, does that apply only in cases where it's on reservation land, or can it apply in cases where the casino here isn't on reservation land? It's on Indian-owned land, but not reservation land. Does that make a difference?
I don't think so, Aaron. I think it's on reservation trust land is what we established at the trial court.
It is on reservation trust land. All right.
And I thought that was very important. We did establish that, again, it's tribal-owned. It's on tribal reservation trust land. These are tribal employees. The Royal River Casino is merely a trade name for an entity that is fully owned and operated by the tribe itself. Again,
does it really matter? Is that a point really of contention? The Fourth Amendment of the federal constitution and the state constitutions would apply anyway because they're within their jurisdictional territory, aren't they?
No, actually the case law seems to say that it is technically 25 U.S. Code, Section 1302.
You mean you have no Fourth Amendment rights if you're on a tribal reservation?
No. You have 25 U.S. Code, Section 1302.
In place of that?
Yes. Okay. I think it would probably depend on the aggressor. If it were a state police officer on tribal land, then it would be the Fourth Amendment. Or a federal officer. If you have a tribal entity, however, exercising powers of self-government on tribal land, then it would be 25 U.S. Code Section 1302.
But the prosecution took place in state court.
Yes, sir.
Not in tribal court.
No, sir.
So does 1302 apply in state court?
Yes. It applies both in state and federal court. It's the same as any other. It's the same as if we had a state court prosecution and we were alleging the Fourth Amendment. It would apply in state court. We have basically three different sovereigns, and that's the whole gist of this issue. I think we need to treat the tribe as a sovereign that, along with the great responsibilities it has in self-government, it has to also caution its agents to not exceed the protections afforded to its citizens.
And again, you still have to prove, even if either the Native American Fourth Amendment or the Constitutional Fourth Amendment, in either case, you have to prove that these were government actors, these security officers, as opposed to private actors. So what evidence is there that these security officers were, in fact, government agents as opposed to just private employees?
And I think that is the entire gist of the case, sir. And again, it's a state action issue. I think Judge Guinat found that these were private security personnel. I don't think that is the case. We established clearly that these are tribal employees. They are government employees. Just because they're tribal government employees and not state government or federal government employees does not change the tenor of what their position is. They are state actors for purposes of our Fourth Amendment analysis by the fact that they are those employees. So we have people that are directly employed by the tribe. We have people that are given special access and authority by the tribe, and also by the Gaming Commission. They have to be licensed. They have to have special training to be able to carry firearms. They have special other training regarding law enforcement, different tactics and things like that. So again, this is something where they are definitely government actors. And the issue is that the government is the tribe.
Are they certified law enforcement?
They are not. And that, again, is another, I think, a big issue here, because what we really, in my opinion, the nub of the case comes down to, I think we have a clear Fourth Amendment violation. I think we have clear state action. But what's our remedy? Do we have an exclusionary rule remedy? Normally, you would have to have law enforcement to be able to have that. So I've gone through, and it's in the, I think, mostly in the reply brief. And our Fourth Amendment analysis through the years has provided protection for more than just law enforcement. There's also been cases where it's been applied to OSHA inspectors, building inspectors, firemen, things like that. In other words, wherever we have this intrusive government-sponsored behavior that arbitrarily invades the privacy rights of a citizen, we can apply the exclusionary rule in those circumstances. But the balancing act that's required.
Sure. And I understand that there's no place, it appears, to put a water glass up there, so if you need it again, just wander back and forth.
Is it that simple, though? You just, if it's a tribal employee, tribe is a government, and therefore whatever the tribal employee does is a government action. Is it that simple, or is there a more refined test about exactly what that employee's functions are? Are they really performing government actions when they search that room, or are they just simply performing the actions that any private security guard would perform in any casino where they suspect that there's a crime going on the business premises?
I couldn't find any authority directly on that question. There is similar analysis that goes to tribal sovereign immunity issues, where, again, we've got casino employees that are being sued for 1983-type violations. So, again, constitutional issues, just not in the criminal context. And in that circumstance, they do find that the casinos themselves are an arm of the tribe. And it's part of the Indian gaming.
What case is that? Is that in your brief?
That is not in my brief. I'm sorry.
Could you give me the cite for that case?
I do. The easiest cite would be 2007 U.S. District Lexus
8988. You know, the rule is, since you're citing the case that you haven't provided, the rule is that you have to provide copies to us and to counsel after the argument.
Mail them in to the clerk.
How many copies, Shirley?
10? Okay.
But certainly would like to see that case.
2007, then, what was the rest of it?
8988. All right. Did that go beyond the 1983? Was that a 1983 case, or was that...
I believe it was. Actually, I think that was the sovereign immunity case, where they were suing the casino entity. They alleged sovereign immunity, and the inquiry there was, is this casino and its employees actually part of the tribal government, was therefore entitled to governmental immunity? So it's the same issue. It's not on point. It's very similar, though, I think it could be persuasive.
Because 1983 actions, they're really looking at a different issue than the question here, whether these people are agents of law enforcement. 1983 is more concerned about whether it's any part of the government that's acted to violate your rights.
Correct. I would agree 100%. And again, I think we have two issues here. We have the Fourth Amendment, which could be a 1983 action. That's just the constitutional violation. I think the nub of this case is the exclusionary rule, which is then, again, where we've got to look at the issue, are these people law enforcement? Our argument is that just because we don't call them law enforcement, they are clearly exercising law enforcement powers. Again, they're in uniforms. They have firearms. They have handcuffs. They apparently are allowed to force their way into hotel rooms. It's never come up that this was beyond their job description or anything like that. So apparently they view this as part of their job, enforcing criminal laws, investigating, enforcing criminal laws.
It's the tribe that actually owns the casino, runs the casino. And that's what would make it different than from Walmart hiring a security guard. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
Isn't there an additional factor here? I mean, we're talking about Fourth Amendment analysis. And that says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and so forth and so forth. The people in that motel room had a right to be secure in their motel room against unreasonable searches and seizures. And isn't that something in addition to whether or not these are state actors? I mean, this is an unreasonable search and seizure. They use trickery by covering the hole in the door, and then they force their way in, and then they seize whatever they see to be seized. But isn't that an unreasonable search and seizure that should be suppressed?
Absolutely. That is our position. And these are state actors. It's just the complicating factor that they are tribal actors.
Okay. Well, my point is aren't we looking at, shouldn't we be looking at whether or not these people have protection against an unreasonable search and seizure, no matter who that is coming, breaking in through the door?
Absolutely. However, the Constitution only provides it from state intrusion. We do have to have state action as well.
You know, the Fourth Amendment doesn't say that. It just says, it says that no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So why wouldn't it apply to Jane Doe or John Doe? Could I walk over there to the Flandreau Casino and bust through the door and see something and then call the police?
And again, I think it's always going to be a technical analysis. You're a state employee. I don't know if you're a law enforcement employee.
Let's say if I wasn't.
I thought if
I'm a law enforcement officer.
That's debatable, huh?
All right, as a private citizen, is it still an unreasonable search and seizure?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
What about the fact that this private security guard smelled marijuana emanating from this motel room?
I think that if this were a trained law enforcement officer, we didn't really have a foundation for this person's ability to smell and detect. But certainly that is something that you could go to a magistrate. A tribal magistrate was right there. I mean, they have a tribal court there in Flandreau to get a search warrant. That's what we do in cases like that. Again, I don't know if it was really that big a deal, but this was the smell of raw marijuana, unburnt marijuana that they thought they smelled. So, in fact,
they could have called the police, who could have come and smelled the raw marijuana, and then they have the right, based on the smell, to do something.
Correct. The officer was eventually called, was also a canine officer. They had a canine stationed in Flandreau. They could have taken that and run him by there, and they could have alerted, and they could have, again, used that to get a warrant. There was no exigent circumstance, however. The smell of marijuana, again, maybe gives rise to suspicion of a violation of a Class 1 misdemeanor. This court has always been clear that we balance the extent of the intrusion versus the severity of the crime. We have an issue where someone possibly has some small amount of marijuana in a hotel room, which we treat like our house. You can't just bust in there to do that. Again, I think the case law is clear on that.
Let's go back to the question of agency and whether they're agents of law enforcement. You know, we haven't talked about it yet, but if I understand the facts correctly, the policy of the casino was that these private security officers didn't make arrests, didn't make prosecutorial decisions. The most they could do was to call a state law enforcement agency, and they would come to the scene, and they would make the decision on whether or not there would be a state arrest and a state prosecution. Is that correct? And if so, how do you maintain agency after that fact?
Well, first of all, I think that it's a mistake to make the analysis be, is this person agent of the state law enforcement who went and got the warrant? I think it's the issue is whether this is an agent of the tribe. That's the agency that we need to collect. And as such, he is the state actor right there. That's the state action. There was a time when the federal government first recognized the exclusionary rule but didn't allow it for the state. That led to a lot of mischief where state police would go ahead and violate a person's Fourth Amendment right, take that illegally seized evidence to a federal enforcement official who would then get a warrant. It was called the Silver Platter Doctrine. That was stopped in 1960. I think we have the same thing here. We have dual sovereigns. We can't allow one to go in and seize something illegally and then just purge that tape by turning it over to state. I think we all the entities here are subject to Fourth Amendment analysis, whether it's not technically the Fourth Amendment, it's the same rule of law that applies to all of them. So again, I don't think it's the agency issue.
Let's suppose it's not a security officer, it's one of the maintenance people there who decides to take it on their own. You know, they smell what they think is marijuana, and so they go ahead and conduct a search. Is that the same thing as a security? Just because the maintenance person works for the tribe, does that mean that the maintenance, that's government action?
Well, that would be a much closer call. I think that would be closer to the issue where we have the maids at the Holiday Inn. If they go in and find it, it's part of their job routine. Now, again, I think if the janitor is doing part of his job routine, he's in there responding to water coming under the door because and he does see that, fine. I think if he goes beyond that, and he is truly a government employee, the same analysis would technically apply. We do have a much stronger case where we have the people that are given the uniforms, given the training, given the special licenses by the tribe.
I want to go back to Justice Zimmer's question because I don't think you answered it completely. He was asking about what the policy is of the security officers there, and I don't know if you answered, maybe I missed it, but was there a policy whereby if the security officers suspected a crime, their policy was to notify local law enforcement?
Yes.
They did not consider themselves investigators.
But their policy was that they would, I have it right here, They're responsible for recording and making reports, documenting the chain of evidence, and ensuring that the crime scene is not disturbed. This is within, I think it was Exhibit E, it's page 56 of the facts.
Is this the SEC 208?
You mean this is SEC 231.
231, okay.
So what happens is when they are illegal activities are received or discovered, they do some minimal investigation. They say there must be substantial evidence before they'll turn it over to the law enforcement. However, it is their policy that they will not make the arrest themselves. They will contact law enforcement. They will detain people and take them into custody.
Does the policy say which law enforcement they turn it over to?
It says sheriff. I'm pretty sure it says sheriff.
Is that a tribal policy, or what are you reading from there?
This is a standard operating procedure. I believe it is of the Flanders Santee Sioux Gaming Commission. The Indian Gambling Reform Regulatory Act requires the formation of this commission to then have the authority to make these rules that must be followed.
The time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Okay. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. The state's going to start from the position that this defendant is a non-Native American. So the state has jurisdiction over him, and I'm not sure where we were headed with the tribe and the tribal court, but that gives us jurisdiction over someone who is non-Native American and has committed a victimless crime like drugs, where we don't have somebody, you know, who's bleeding to death. And that gets lost somewhere in this analysis. As far as the agency issue, federal courts have developed a test to determine agency. And if you look at that test, the state of South Dakota is not telling these security guards how to operate. We're not asking them to go into this entry. We're not acquiescing in it. We're not making a request that they do that for us or for the local police. And so our position is that the security guards who are acting that day and entering the defendant's room were acting on their own initiative. And if you look at Long Crow's specific testimony during the preliminary hearing, he says, "I am not law enforcement. I don't represent myself as law enforcement, and I'm acting on my own initiative," as were the other fellow officers that were with him. And in terms of, I don't think that the defense has met the agency test for someone who is non-Native American. They're not going to jump into federal court or into a tribal court because he's not Native American, which is a different jurisdictional issue in this case. The next point would be that the exclusionary rule wouldn't apply in this case because we don't have state law enforcement officers. We don't have tribal.
Can you put the microphone just a little bit?
Oops, sorry.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm short. Maybe you're lucky you missed my argument, but.
We heard it. We just didn't hear it as well as we'd like to.
Okay, I apologize for that. I'm sorry. I didn't realize Mr. Jacob was that tall. Anyway, my point would be that the state would have jurisdiction over the defendant, not the tribe, because he's not Native American. Those are the jurisdictional parameters of our state. That's how it works. The tribe's a separate sovereign, and we're separate.
But is this analogous to a situation where a non-Native person is arrested on tribal on a reservation and turned over to the state authorities because the tribal officers have found evidence of a crime on his person? Is that analogous?
A little different because the tribal officers presume and the state officers are cross-deputized in this area of the state. The security guards are not in that position, to my knowledge. This record doesn't show that they are. So that's a little different scenario. These security guards are acting in the interests of their employer and for the protection of the company assets, employees, other people in the casino, that type of thing. So I don't see it as the same, or the state would see it as different.
I don't think every tribal officer is cross-deputized, but assume that we have a tribal officer who's not, who just simply catches a non-tribal member on the reservation with evidence of a state crime, let's say marijuana. Well, the tribal officer won't prosecute, won't take them to the tribal authorities. They'll turn them over to the state authorities for prosecution. Is that not analogous to what we have here?
I see it as a little different, but let's assume that's true. I think we had a case a long time ago where that happened, and they drug, so to speak, I can't think of the name of it, Winkler, and they drug him over the line. Yeah, in that case, I can see what you're getting at. And the state took jurisdiction and didn't prosecute him. But I think State v. Winkler, that was the case. I do remember a case like that. I guess we're trying to distinguish the situation because these security guards are like rent-a-cops, and that's a different scenario. They're being hired for this job.
Except they're not private. I mean, the security guards are, they're not a private firm, you know, Safety Incorporated. They're a tribal employee. In fact, you know, looking at the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, it requires that only tribes can own casinos, and that under that act, the casinos exist for the purpose of funding tribal government and helping tribes to be self-sufficient. So the operation of a casino is a tribal government action. It isn't a private business the way, you say, a casino in downtown Brookings might be or in Las Vegas. It's actually a tribal government function. In fact, Congress says that's the only reason you're entitled to have a casino if you're a tribe, is to help you run your government and fund your government. So doesn't that make this a closer question about whether these employees are actually tribal government agents?
It does make it a closer issue, but, you know, in doing research for this, we're not involved in that, in what the tribe is doing under the compact to regulate what these security guards are doing. So it's more attenuated than that as far as, you know, the state would do would be doing criminal background checks on people that are handling the money and making a recommendation. I'm outside my record, but making a recommendation whether to hire fire or hire with recommendations. We don't tell the Indian Regulatory Gaming Commission how to operate or what to do.
But I see what you're saying is that the Fourth Amendment or South Dakota's equivalent doesn't apply because this is a tribal government action.
That's correct.
But doesn't the Native American version of the Fourth Amendment apply in this situation? And are we required, it's federal law, aren't we required to enforce it?
The state's position would be no, because we have this situation where we've got agents, people who are not agents of the state with someone who's non-Indian. And I think if you look at cases like People v. Ramirez and footnotes in there, courts, at least the California Supreme Court or appellate court, distinguished this kind of situation when you have a non-Native American with a victimless drug crime and said that it's not the same. I think the state was arguing that to try to prevent the exclusionary rule from applying in that footnote. This is a different situation. I think when you look at this at first blush, I struggle with that too. You think that the tribe is probably controlling the strings. But there is a difference between what the compact does, which is regulate gaming and gambling and those types of things, and the overall issue, larger issue of crimes other than theft in that casino by the officials, the employees, and other people in there. We have this larger issue of other crimes. That's ours. We've got a non-Native American. That belongs to the state. The Indian Civil Rights Act is not what we're worried about. We're worried about our Constitution, because that's what governs state governments, although they're analogous in terms of their provisions.
But ultimately, it really doesn't matter which rule applies, because the Fourth Amendment reasonableness requirement's the same.
I'm sorry?
Well, it doesn't matter whether it's the Indian Act or the U.S. Constitution. In either case, the principles of the Fourth Amendment apply.
The principles of the Fourth Amendment, they parallel each other. Some of the cases they mimic, they parallel each other. But I think you still have to keep foremost in mind the jurisdictional limitations that exist for the tribe and for the state. And that's when, you know, the crossover.
Well, tell me again, then, how is that relevant in this case? The limitation.
Largely because we have to fight it off, because that's what the defense is raising. And you have to distinguish this situation from what he's saying, which is that somehow there are tribal police officers or state police officers that are akin to these private security guards. And my job is to tell you that this case belonged in state court, that we had jurisdiction over this defendant, and that because of his status as a non-Native American person, that the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution would apply to this case if we didn't have private security guards. And Judge Guinea found that we had private actors in this case. So in that sense, it doesn't apply at all, whether we're talking about the Indian Gaming Act or we're talking about the Fourth Amendment. I guess we end up with the same result. And I'm afraid I cut off Justice Meyer Henry with a question. Someone there? Okay, I apologize.
I forgot it by now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Between the mic and everything else, I may have lost your question.
Well, it seems to me, though, we're doing, I guess my question was, at one point when you were talking about the jurisdictional differences, is that you're, which follows Justice Zinner's question, it's still the same analysis, though, isn't it? If they're tribal employees, isn't that something we still have to look at, whether or not they're an arm of the, or agents of the law enforcement that originally, or that ultimately gets them into state court? It's still that link that we have to, I mean, that doesn't break that link, does it, automatically, just because it's a different jurisdiction?
Well, I may have misunderstood Justice Zinner's question, and I apologize if I did. But, the link is something that's important, particularly because we have the People v. Ramirez case that the defense has raised, in which Congress says states can't use evidence from the Indian Civil Rights Act if they violated the exclusionary rule. By the same token, the states can't use that in evidence, and that's what happened. In that case, the state of California was prohibited from using the evidence. So the link is something there. We're just saying the link isn't there. And if I didn't say that right, I apologize. We're saying that these are private actors, that they are rent-a-cops, that they don't rise to the level of state law enforcement or tribal law enforcement officers. And that's what Judge Guinea found by looking at all the evidence in this case.
Is this a question of law or question? Is there any factual finding here that's we look at? Or is it basically under those facts that everybody agrees to is a question of law? De novo.
Well, any constitutional issue is always de novo. Suppression is de novo. The application of facts are clearly erroneous. So when we're looking at Judge Guinea's facts, and certainly this court can look at it de novo and kind of shove it into that legal analysis and see where it stands. Our argument, my argument from the state's perspective, would be that there isn't a link there that the defense is trying to manufacture there, because this is a different, it is a unique situation in that sense, because the security guards are aligned with a particular government entity. They're not fire inspectors, they're not building inspectors. There's not a licensing entity that they're reporting to. They have their own internal procedures. They wear their own uniforms, have their own handcuffs, have their own weapons. It's not state-sponsored or, it's a unilateral type of thing. from the state's reading of the record. And do you have any other questions?
Guess not.
On that issue? Okay. I'll keep it brief, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Durhag-Opian, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I think the first issue I would like to address, again, I think we have a lot more than what has been termed here rent-a-cops. Again, rent-a-cops work for private firms. This is somebody that actually works for the tribal government. Not only that, they are licensed by the tribal government. They have to be licensed for that position. They have to also have a license to carry their firearms. They are authorized to enforce federal laws on the casino as far as cheating or any theft in the casino. So to a limited extent, they are law enforcement. They do have that.
You say they're licensed. Licensed to do what?
I'm sorry. It's called a key gaming license. It just involves a background check. And again, it's just a requirement of the job. Another requirement of the job, and the reason why I put that into the record, was that we show exactly what they have to go through. They have to have some either law enforcement or military or other prior experience as well. So it's not just anybody off the street that they can go and give this license to and get a gun to and turn them loose in the hotel. Again, I certainly think this eventually gets down to the exclusionary rule. To me, as long as we're doing an honest analysis of Section 1302 and using that as a framework for whether or not these people are acting on behalf of a tribal entity, a state actor, if you will, it comes down to the exclusionary rule. What do we want?
When you say state actor, it's a little confusing.
It is.
Because you're really talking about government actor here. They're not acting for South Dakota. They're acting for tribal government, right?
So right. I'm using state actor as a term of art in Fourth Amendment analysis.
Right.
And it is confusing because we have the three entities here. So that's what I meant it to mean. I think what we always look at in the exclusionary rules is something that we want to prevent. Clearly, we have people in hotel rooms. We want them to feel secure and in their homes, as it were. But I think there's another issue that you want to look at, too. We have people with weapons, firearms, forcing their way in the hotel rooms against suspected criminals. This is a very dangerous practice. These are not actually trained law enforcement people doing this. These are just people that work for the tribe who have some minimum of training, and they've got firearms, and they're breaking into rooms. Somebody could easily get killed, either by stopping them or someone shooting the law enforcement or the security personnel, or vice versa. This could get out of hand very quickly. We can't have cowboy activity doing things that they're not allowed to do. I really do think there's a danger element here that should be considered as well. That's really all I have to say, unless there's further questions.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Durhag.
Thank you, sir.